Theories and ideas on many different subjects. You can find more at redeyescreations.com, and you'll find our entire archives at redeyesmembers.com. Richard Grove is the founder of Tragedy and Hope, which enables individuals to research and form groups of independent thinkers to solve humanity's most pressing problems. Prior to this, Richard worked as an account executive in New York City, selling enterprise software and services to the world's largest financial services companies. After discovering that his corporation was selling software with a backdoor, which allowed illicit transactions to take place beyond oversight, he blew the whistle, which led him into court from 2003 to 2007. In the first hour, Richard shares his Wall Street whistleblowing experience and connects 9/11, insider trading, and conspiracy. He tells his story and shares his witness account of what happened on the morning of September 11th, 2001, as he had a meeting that day on the 96th floor of the World Trade Center North Tower when it was struck. All right, welcome back, Richard. It's good to talk to you once again. Thank you for coming back on and taking the time talking with us. Looking forward to this one.
It's always a pleasure to join you. I'm also seeking the authentic, and I think today's excursion into the unknown should be very interesting.
You bet. And this will be a prequel to our last program when we talked about the outcome, if you will, and the effects. Of course, your website, tragedyandhope.com, and the work you consequently have done. So today we're going to rewind the tape and return and begin at the beginning to talk about your experiences surrounding September 11th. And as you know, we have Mark Gaffney with us. As you helped us to get in contact with him, thank you for that. And we know that you're featured in his new book, Black 9/11, and your story is right smack in the middle and the center of everything here pertaining to insider trading and where the trails will going to lead us, of course. So, and it's a big story, lots of different components to it. So why don't you begin at the beginning, Richard, and try to kind of set the stage a little bit for our listeners that might not be aware of your story or how you kind of what your part in all of this is, Richard.
Well, first, I want to say that you did an outstanding job with Mark Gaffney, and he got a lot of great facts. A lot of the contradictions that are out there that are substantial but lesser known, lesser talked about, a lot of the corporate connections. And for my part, I will say that my whole role in 9/11 and researching all this is kind of inadvertent, and it's been like an ongoing 11-year unscheduled meeting that I didn't plan for in my life. And I can laugh about it now, but I was very confused and frustrated, and the world was in chaos for a couple years as I tried to figure this out. And so I guess the best way to set the stage is I was, born in Western Pennsylvania. I went to public school. I went to a state university. I got my degree. I had started my own business while I was in college because I had to work to put myself through college, and I discovered it was easier to start my own business than to keep working at places and getting underpaid. And that really gave me the experience I needed to go out into the corporate world and to get into a job in sales. Now, I discovered through running my own business in college that sales was something that they don't give a degree in. And it kind of gave a question of why are there no universities giving degrees in sales when every company has to have a product plus sales to equal some sort of revenue?
Yeah.
And it dawned on me that it's almost like secret knowledge that has to be out there in society for it to run, but they don't want to pass out through public school because it would be caustic to the sales profession for everyone to know the techniques of sales. But really what I learned in years later was the techniques of sales were just applied techniques of propaganda and public relations laid out by Walter Lippmann and Edward Bernays back in the 1920s. So I was highly naive. I went into corporate world working as a salesperson, and I had to make a choice. Now, a lot of my friends that I knew that were doing something like that were going into pharmaceuticals, and I wasn't interested. I knew enough at that time to be skeptical of pharmaceutical companies. I just didn't have all the facts behind it. And I didn't want to sell something that could possibly cause people health problems or, you know, even worse.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went into the profession of software sales because I felt that was very safe and non-confrontational, and it's not really playing into any of these big world issues. It's a safe place to make a living. Or so I thought, right?
Right.
And I started, you know, working at these companies. I did very well. I went from one job to another, practically doubling my income between one job to another. And so at a very young age, I experienced a high level of success, and I had basically earned enough money to do all the things that I thought I wanted to do in life as I was conditioned to want. And I did a really good job of jumping through the hoops of public school and, you know, excelling at being a good student and being a good, you know, corporate employee and all these things. And that was all working fine for me. And I really thought that I was happy. I didn't really feel satisfied, but I thought, well, this is what I've been conditioned to want. I've got the fancy car. I've got the great apartment. I have a good job. I can go and travel the world and do all these things. And I thought that was, well, I thought mistakenly, maybe that was my purpose on this planet. And as I continued to experience success, then I started to have a little bit more time to stop and think about things. And it was over a series of months, probably in the year 2000, going into 2001, where I really, you know, I had a lot more time. I didn't have to focus on my job as much. I had a lot more time to just consider, you know, what I wanted to do in the world and these sort of things. And it was that time of contemplation where I started thinking about things that I started noticing contradictions. Now, it was, January of 2001.
Mm-hmm.
I'm working at a company called Silverstream Software. And this was the height, I guess, of the dot-com bubble. And so you've got all these companies in New York that want to take all their legacy computer systems, their mainframes, and they want to put this information on the web. And so in learning how to, sell these different products, I had various clients in New York. And one of those clients was Deutsche Bank, and we had done this big installation, a prototype for them to do online trading. And then I landed this client, I guess it was a couple months before, it was October of 2000 when I closed the deal, Marsh & McLennan, which was the world's largest insurance brokerage. So by January of 2001, I'm working in the World Trade Center. I'm on the 96th floor, and there's, you know, like 30 or 40 developers from Silverstream and some people that we've hired out to do this work at Marsh & McLennan. Now, they had I don't want to get into all the technical aspects of their project, but suffice to say, they had a bunch of mainframes and legacy systems that they wanted to put online, and they wanted to interact with their clients using online transactions instead of mailing things through the post office. So Marsh & McLennan is seeking to reduce the time of turnaround in their insurance products, and they have a substantial business, so this was a big account, and so things were pretty good for me in January of 2001. A couple months later, there's a phase two that we're planning for to do it at Marsh & McLennan, and I closed this deal. I got a verbal confirmation from the chief technology officer, and it was for $5 million. So this is a substantial phase two. They have high confidence in what we've done in phase one. I was supposed to make like $1 million in commission out of this deal. And the next morning I go into work and I get called into my boss's office. And my boss's boss is standing behind the door and he closes it behind me, which kind of surprised me because he's from out of town. He's from Boston. And he closes the door and says, "Rich, today's not your lucky day." And so I was a little confused because I had never been fired before. And so, you know, from my perspective, I had closed a big deal. My boss wanted to take the money for the commission, take credit, and they didn't need me now that I've done the hard work. So I'd seen this thing happen to other people, but I never thought it would happen to me. So that's kind of where my naivete started to get chipped away at, you know, by reality. But at that point, I still had, you know, a considerable amount of money in the bank. I had grown to not worry so much, and I really just took the summer off, and I started relaxing and traveling and spending some of the money that I had, you know, spent all these years earning. So keep in mind, I'm like 28 or 29 at the time. I don't really have clear objectives for my future. I really hadn't thought too much about what if my career ended, you know, this sort of stuff. So I felt confident that I could just take a couple months off and go back and get another job. Well, I had another, you know, unscheduled meeting happen in August of 2001. I found myself in a hospital for a couple days with a serious ailment, which they couldn't figure out, and I had to have emergency surgery. And a couple days later, I get approached by the chief financial officer from the company that terminated me in June. And the termination date in June was June 4th, 2001. So this is August. It's like August 21st, 24th, something like that. And they make me an offer that I couldn't refuse. I had just gotten out of the hospital. The health care that they had given me in my termination was, you know, about to be expired. And they offered me an extension in my health care. And they offered me $9,999. And so I signed a piece of paper, they gave me a check, and they gave me more health care.
Mm-hmm.
But then I started thinking even more. Because I was like, they don't just give people money for nothing. Like, I had already signed a contract, you know, non-compete, all, you know, non-disclosure, all this stuff when I got terminated. And I was asking myself, why would they come and just offer me this money and, you know, there's something going on. So then I had some documents that I'd gotten right after I got terminated because I wanted to see what were the circumstances that happened 24 hours before I got terminated. And the email that I looked at that I, you know, had had for a couple months but really hadn't paid attention to, it was from the client, Marcia McLennan. And my question was, why were we overbilling them and why wasn't I being paid if we were going to overbill them? Like, why does my commission not match what we're billing them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I figured I'd get just, you know, an answer that, you know, I missed out on a spreadsheet or something like that. And the answer that came back was, there's this guy at Marsh & McLennan who's sitting on all these numbers and all these hours and this and that. And so he's the roadblock. And so I knew that same guy was the one who was basically leading the project that's going to get a bunch of people fired, because once they do the legacy migration off all these systems, they weren't going to let the people that did the migration participate in the new e-commerce aspect, which we all found to be kind of fishy, but, you know, that's how it was.
Sure.
So I had these documents, and I was like, well, I'm going to go, you know, because I developed a, you know, a friendship with several people at Marsh over the years working, you know, on this account for the past, well, at that point it was about 9 months and after we closed it, but we did several months before we closed the deal. So, you know, we had built a relationship. I had been to some of these people's, you know, birthday parties and stuff like that. So I just felt obligated to provide some sort of warning. And so I wanted to drop these documents off and just basically say, hey, look, here's what I know from my side. Something fishy's going on, but I don't work here anymore. I can't really do anything about this on my end, but I thought you guys should know. So it's now we've worked our way up to Friday, September, I think it was the 7th. It was definitely Friday. I was having dinner at Windows on the World in the World Trade Center, which is, you know, the restaurant at the top of the building. And I was there with a prospective employer who had just tendered an employment offer that was beyond my expectations. I had a buddy who worked for the company. They were in town. He said, let's meet up for dinner. So I took him to dinner in the restaurant that I had been taking clients to for the past, you know, 9 months. And so we had this conversation, and I'm blown away. And, I probably had a couple martinis at dinner. And so I was feeling a little cocky. And so I made this phone call and left a message with Norma Taddy, who was the executive assistant for my contact at Marsh of the highest level, you know, that we worked with daily, Catherine Lee. And she was in charge of the Lotus Notes project for migration. And she was really the counterpart that I worked with. So I left this message and I said, I've got these documents, and, you know, Norma had been somebody who had given me good advice before. So I said, you know, I left this message and said, what do you think I should do with them? So I got a voicemail back on Monday, and Norma's like, I asked and I was told that you should drop these documents off tomorrow morning around 9:15. And there's two meetings going on. And in between these meetings, if you drop these documents off, they would like to confront the executive. Now, in hindsight, the executive that they're confronting also had Norma as an executive assistant because he had like a temporary office and he was in and out because he had come from Deloitte & Touche. So he was, you know, someone brought in by Jeffrey Greenberg personally to do all this. And so I'm just dropping off documents, and then I'm going to my buddy's beach house and, you know, for the rest of that week, and that next weekend was the end of their renting of this house for the summer. So I just planned to drop these documents off and go to the beach. So I'm in shorts and a shirt, and I've got the top down. I've got my, you know, backpack, you know, packed with stuff. And I'm driving down to the World Trade Center on Tuesday, September 11th, a little bit before 9 o'clock. It's a beautiful morning. Crystal clear skies. Quiet, sunny, warm, you know? So it's like there's not a thing wrong in the world at that point. And then I get down below Canal Street, and I notice, you know, I'm sitting in a red light, and then the light turns green, and nothing's moving. And so then I start to look, you know, what's the cause of this traffic? And I look up, and there's smoke coming out of the offices where I'm supposed to go to in a couple minutes.
Yeah.
And, it, you know, I hear on the radio in other cars, you know, they're listening to 1010 Winds, this AM station that gives the news. A lot of cabs, all the cabs listen to it and stuff like that. So I'm in traffic. I got the top down. And I can hear something's going on in the radio. So I turned my radio on because I was playing the CD. So at that point, it's just like there's been an accident. There's a fire up there, definitely. You know, there's black smoke pouring out of the side of the building. And they say on the radio that it was a helicopter. And I think to myself, that's totally realistic. Because I remember looking out of the window on those offices on the 96th floor, 97th floor, 98th floor, where we had development and all this stuff going on. And you could see helicopters flying below you at 800 or 900 feet. So that made total sense in the first couple seconds, you know, of this event that I'm witnessing. Because a helicopter could easily have blown into the building. And that might be what it looks like. And then they said it was a Cessna. And I thought, wow, you know, Cessnas, they're really small. That could easily blow into the building or wind shear or something like that. And I don't think I remember hearing them say on the radio that it was a commercial airliner. At that point, you know, the whole time I was there, it was an accident. Mm-hmm. It was an accident. It was a tragic accident. I was hoping that my friends and coworkers can get out of the building safely. A lot of those people had survived the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, which was provably conducted and carried out by the Federal Bureau of Investigation.
Yep.
It was the FBI. They paid an Egyptian militant, Imad Salem. He recorded the conversations with Agent John Antosev, if I remember correctly. You can hear them on, if you Google. They're on Wikipedia. So a lot of these people had survived, and I thought they're just, you know, they're going to find their way down the stairs. It's going to take them a while to get out. You know, this is all going to probably, you know, have a happy ending somehow. Well, I was naive, and I was about to discover that for real. So in the next couple minutes, I make a left onto Vesey Street. I'm in a car with the top down, and there's a lot of debris, and there's things falling and people falling out of the building.
And you can see that from where you are at this point.
It's a gruesome, traumatic event.
Yeah.
I mean, I had never experienced anything like it. And so as that is shocking me, you know, it's only, you know, about 18 minutes between the first event and the second event. And so when Tower 2, when the South Tower explodes, I'm there. I had already wanted to seriously leave the situation, even though I felt like, well, I'd be a coward to leave. I need to see, you know, if there's anything I can do, this sort of thing, right?
Yeah.
But I also knew that I had a top down and there's crazy stuff going on and debris. And at the same time that Tower 2 explodes up in the air, there's a series of flashes in World Trade Center 6, like explosions inside the building. Now, I have considered that since there's a lot of glass on World Trade Center 6, that it could have been a reflection from something behind me in World Trade Center 7. But in examining the evidence afterwards, there are huge holes blown in World Trade Center 6 underground that go down to the train tracks. That was the customs house. There's gold stored under there. There's a whole bunch of contradictions. But all I know is that I thought it was an accident until the second event happened in the South Tower. And then some event happened in World Trade Center 6 that I knew had to be connected because they're happening simultaneously. And that's when I panicked. And I left, and I drove as fast as I could down a one-way street the wrong way. And by the time I made the left into the Holland Tunnel, there was there's military in camouflage. There's a guy walking a wooden barricade across the street to block off the Holland Tunnel. And I'm thinking, what are they doing here? How did they get here this fast? And why, like, what's going on?
Mm.
And so at that moment, so I'm driving through the Holland Tunnel to go into New Jersey, and all these different things are going through my head because I have no reference for this. I have no reference for this. And so, you know, I make a left, I go start heading south in Jersey, and I'm flooring it because I figure at this point, like, all hell's breaking loose. And a couple minutes, you know, like 10 or 15 minutes later, there's a, you know, this event at the Pentagon. So that happens while I'm driving down to my buddy's house in Princeton. And we never get to go to the beach because I drive down there. I knew if I got pulled over, like, whoever pulled me over does not know what's going on, because it was like the sky is falling, literally and figuratively.
Yep.
And so I get down to my buddy's house, and I go inside, and he's still sleeping. And I turn on the TV. I go upstairs. I'm like, dude, you got to get up. Something's going on. And, you know, it was only a couple minutes after that that you see the towers fall. And I was like, whoa. Like, that's not normal. That does not compute. But then you are easily within like a couple minutes of, actually, before the towers fell, I think it's Andrea Koppel, who's a reporter for CNN. I might have her name wrong, but she's Alan Greenspan's wife. And she's the first person on MSNBC who calls in and says, it's Osama bin Laden. Okay. Now, I didn't get that morning. I only get that from rewatching, you know, what the tapes and the footage from all the different channels in my research.
The Greenspan's wife is saying this on MSNBC. Right. About how long after, again, did you say?
Andrea Mitchell, I think, is her name.
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't know that at the time. All I knew at the time was they're telling us it's terrorism. They got this whole story that they rolled out. And I became a victim of the psychological warfare of the snuff film that is 9/11. That's a snuff film that they use to traumatize not only people in America, but all over the world. And it's been used as the premise for all these other crazy foreign political actions and all the crazy domestic actions like the Patriot Act, which they also pre-printed and rolled out right away.
Yeah.
And they passed with no one reading it. So the first couple weeks afterwards, I'm in a state of shock. It took like 3 days, I think, before they opened the bridges so I could get back to my apartment in the city. And the drive back from Princeton into New York, you could smell the bodies. You could smell like the smoke was just, it smelled like death. And you could smell that in New Jersey. Like before I even got close to the George Washington Bridge, I could smell, you know, before, like, you know, it was crazy.
Sure.
So then I spent the next couple weeks, you know, taking stuff down to Ground Zero, you know, doing a lot of walking around the city, like just taking pictures and stuff and just really appreciating being alive. Now, I had no idea that being near Ground Zero was like it was going to have toxic effects like it did for all those first responders and the search dogs that died right away. Because there's obviously there's radiation and there's things happening to those first responders that are unexplained from the official story.
Yeah.
Right? And so none of that really hits you until later on. So I'm just in the you know, Patriot mode. I'm just trying to help out and lend a hand and, you know, do whatever I can and you know, concentrate on something other than this thing I can't understand and I don't have any answers for. So I think it was like a month or so later, so that was definitely in October. I had to go to a bunch of memorial services for colleagues that worked at Marsh & McLennan because they had lost like 326 people. And so I'm in this, I can't even describe what it is. It was in St. Patrick's Cathedral, famous cathedral in New York City. There's Rudy Giuliani and all the people that we now know are deeply associated with the contradictions of 9/11. They're up in front of the families, and they're like, you know, we're so sorry for you and all this stuff. And I started to notice more contradictions. And then I bumped into some people who, you know, didn't go to work that day and, you know, this sort of thing. And mm-hmm. I was like, well, who else didn't go to work that day? And they're like, well, so-and-so and so-and-so, I don't want to use his name on live on the radio, but I sure. think Gaffney does have it in his book because he discovered it on his own. He stayed home from work that morning, and that was the executive they were confronting with, you know, my paperwork, who was doing all this contradictory, activity as far as we all saw it, as, you know, from our naive perspective. So I later found out that individual was in a partnership with someone in the CFR and has connections to other intelligence groups that played a role in 9/11. So when I looked into who owns, like, what is Marsh & McLennan? I should have known this stuff as, you know, someone who handled their account, but you only learn what you know, what they want you to know from, like, Hoover's or one of these databases that you look up in a company information, right? Mm-hmm. Well, when you get into the nature of Marsh & McLennan, they had a very, very close partnership with this other company called AIG, which to me at the time was, you know, it was just an insurance company. It was a really big insurance company, and we had done some work for them as well, connecting the Marsh project that we were doing for the internet, connecting them to AIG. In fact, they did the first successful test of all this new technology with AIG. Now, if you fast forward a couple years later, you've got AIG and Marsh being prosecuted by Elliot Spitzer for stealing from their clients hundreds of billions of dollars. Now, I think they had to pay a fee of $800 million to do that, because that's what the fine is. It's just the fee for the theft, right? So when provably later these two companies used an electronic, you know, a transaction system to cheat their clients, to cheat their partners, they get caught, and they get caught by Elliot Spitzer. Now, going back to the history of AIG and Marsh, let me start with AIG. You've got a guy named Morris Greenberg who goes by the name of Hank, because there used to be a famous baseball player here called Hank Greenberg. And Morris Hank Greenberg, was a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. He was a chairman of the Federal Reserve. He's close buddies with Peter G. Peterson of the Blackstone Group, which helped to ensure the World Trade Center complex. So there's all these connections, especially to the OSS. Now, people listening, if you are near a browser, you want to type in this article title from the LA Times. The secret agent it's called the secret insurance agent men, if memory serves. That goes into the history of the OSS and CIA using Hank Greenberg, Cornelius Starr, who founded AIG, and how it's a front company. So now, in hindsight, I'm learning that AIG is a front company that has a very powerful guy in charge named Hank Greenberg, who inherited it from Cornelius V. Starr, who's the uncle of Kenneth Starr that prosecuted Clinton while we were bombing Yugoslavia. So there's all these interesting historical connections I'm coming across, but then I find some things I can't believe. Hank Greenberg's two sons are also chairman and CEOs of large insurance companies. His son Alex was a chairman at a company called Ace Insurance, and his son Jeffrey was the CEO of Marsh & McLennan. So now you've got this whole family affair involved in the companies that are attacked, the insurance that's taken on the property, and all these other things. And then I discovered this company called Kroll Associates. Now, Kroll Associates was purchased by AIG and later sold to Marsh & McLennan. Kroll Associates they got involved in the World Trade Center after the 1993 bombing, and they had hired this guy named John O'Neill. John O'Neill was the counterterrorism August of 2001. He was Osama bin Laden's top tracker, a guy who catched bin Laden. And he gets set up in August. He gets fired. He gets hired by Kroll. Kroll, you know, is the security for the World Trade Center complex. O'Neill shows up for his day at work on September 11th and dies. Now, the official story says he died on the 33rd floor of World Trade Center 1, but if you cross-reference that, that's a vacant floor. And William Rodriguez also mentions it in his testimony as being a vacant floor, but he heard noises coming from up there, right? So the guy who's suspect is this other character named Jerome Hauer, who works in biological warfare. He also worked in Giuliani's administration in the emergency bunker in World Trade Center 7. And he's the guy who allegedly finds Jerome Hauer, finds John O'Neill's body and identifies him, right? So I don't know how he found John O'Neill's body on the 33rd floor and identified him before the tower came down and all this other stuff, but I digress. There are more contradictions when you look into who is Marsha McLennan and who is AIG. At the time that Spitzer, and Spitzer was, you know, he was a cocky attorney general, and then he became governor of New York. Spitzer goes after Marsha McLennan, and there's a couple great articles on this. And basically he's saying in these articles and these interviews, I couldn't understand why Marsh wasn't being forthcoming with, you know, and cooperating with the investigation. And what he was missing was there was a huge scam behind the little tiny tip of the iceberg he was chipping on that they didn't want him to get to. And so there's a very clever move that happens. There was this guy in charge of Kroll Associates named Michael Cherkasky. And after AIG transfers Kroll to Marsh, Cherkasky from Kroll then becomes the Marsh CEO and can defend Marsh against Spitzer. Then the question was, why would Marsh and McLennan put this guy in charge and put him up against Spitzer? Oh, it just so happens that Spitzer, Giuliani, Cherkasky all used to work for Robert Morgenthau, the longtime district attorney of New York City, who got his job when Frank Hogan was suspiciously murdered in the 70s, but I digress on that. So now you've got this guy, Cherkasky, who brought Spitzer into Morgenthau's office and basically gave him his start, and he's there as the wall. And the wall works because Spitzer ends up getting caught, you know, through this whole Ken Langone setup with the hooker,
yeah.
And all of this stuff eventually goes away. AIG gets nationalized. It gets bailed out. It gets billions and billions and billions of dollars. And nobody says boo. Now, these are the things that have happened after 9/11. But these aren't the things that really clued me into the things that led me here. What led me here was realizing that there were insider trades on Marsh and McLennan and American Airlines. These were put options that were scheduled in the weeks before 9/11 that highly, highly, incredibly point to foreknowledge. And when I discovered these things, my question was, how did the Arab hijackers do this? And then when I trace the trades, they go to Deutsche Bank and Alex Brown, which was one of the ex-clients that we had built trading platforms for. And at that time, it was being, I think at that time, Buzzy Krongard had left, but he was the number three at CIA. So Buzzy Krongard was working for Alex Brown and then leaves, but then Alex Brown does these trades on 9/11. So here's somebody who's number three at the CIA who had worked for this investment bank, and when you do the research into the CIA, it was all started by Wall Street lawyers and bankers. So the intelligence agencies really work for the banks because the banks are used to fund and control governments. This is international political history for the past 300 years. We're not taught this in public schools. And this is a big reason why they can perpetrate things like 9/11, because it's a history that we don't know that allows tyranny to grow. And as they changed our education system, they've basically bred out our ability to recognize the contradictions and to communicate effectively with other people in the audience. And so that kind of brings us up to current day, where I feel the need to produce media and to teach a class of intellectual self-defense, so that people can not only understand what's going on now, but more importantly, what is the history that has led us here to the situation we find ourselves in today?
Oh, wow. What a story. Where do one begin to talk more about this deconstructor? There's so many aspects here I want to get deeper into and just try to kind of, pick your brain, if you will, a little bit about this, because it's... Well, it's rare to talk with someone who was there. I know there are insiders and whistleblowers who speak out about this, of course. But you were sitting there. You were, just to clarify one thing first of all here, you were meant then to be in the offices at the time the plane hit. Is that correct?
Well, I would have, you know, I don't have the answer to that, but from the evidence and the information that I've been exposed to, the person who tried to put me there, I make a call on Friday. I left the voicemail. So I kind of did expect to have to go down there and drop these documents off. However, whoever directed Norma Taddy to leave me a voicemail with a specific time, it wasn't Catherine Lee because she died that day. It wasn't Gary Lasko, her boss, that you know gave me the verbal consent on the deal because he died that day. The only other person who could have done that stayed home that morning and conducted that meeting via a conference call. And the only other person above him who was adjacent, there was the chief information officer. Her name slips my mind right now. But she was in a meeting in London at Marsh's office. She was also on that conference call. And in interviews about 9/11, she says she was on the conference call remotely with the group that was in the World Trade Center, and the line goes dead.
Yeah.
So, and I would suspect that the person who was appointed by Jeffrey Greenberg, son of Hank Greenberg, had actionable information, just as Larry Silverstein received that morning.
Yeah, and so many others.
And so many others, yes.
Wow. Yeah, so when we talked with Mark about this, he had a feeling, and I guess some of this in part then obviously comes from you as well, the interview he did with you for the information in the book, that maybe the whole operation per se in that way, or even the technology, I don't know how much data you have about this or what's your hunch, or we can break this up, of course, we talk about specifically what you know specifically, and then we can get into you know what you feel or what your senses is in terms of what really happened. But he proposed the theory that the whole operation might have been to a certain extent run from Marshall McLennan's office, because that was the first the first plane that hit this floor. That's correct, right?
So the way I like to deal with it is to clear the table of all evidence and assumptions, and then bring back onto the table of evidence that which we know without a doubt and that nobody disputes, so that we can start on the same page.
Yeah.
So I can agree that World Trade Center 1, World Trade Center 2, and the Pentagon, as well as World Trade Center 7, all suffered explosions. Now, the only footage of a plane hitting World Trade Center 1 is from the Nade brothers, and that is highly suspect footage. That was one of the first things I looked at back in 2006 before I started the 9/11 Synchronicity podcast. There's a lot of contradictions in that, and that's the only shot that's available of that. And the Occam's razor would say, if you control that real estate and you control the investigation, what's the easiest way to make a building explode like that? Well, it's from the inside, not from the outside. Now, I'm not disputing any of that. I'm just saying that those buildings exploded. So now the next step would be, you know, there's the official story, and it says there's hijackers and there's planes, and they drive the planes into the buildings. That sounds like a story, so let's check it out. What is the chain of custody on the evidence concerning the hijackers? Oh, it's controlled by Marvin Bush and Kroll Associates and, you know, these different groups that do security for the government. So, you know, the tapes, all the evidence that they found, the passport, that was found by Bernie Carrick at the World Trade Center, and he later went to jail for fraud. The other alleged passport at Flight 93's alleged crash site, that doesn't check out either. The plane disappears, but there's a passport with the guy's face left on it.
Yeah.
That is an orgy of evidence that is artificially left there for other people to find naively. And that's where you get, you know, some of the FBI whistleblowers also find the orgy of evidence, and then they blow the whistle on it, and it seems to say, oh, there was foreknowledge, but we couldn't get the technology couldn't work. We had all these systems, but they weren't connected together so that people could – that's all on purpose. That's a red herring. So let's go back to the evidence. If there were planes used, there's several ways to identify a plane. There's unique serial numbers, there's a transponder, there's a radar signature, there's tail numbers, there's all these different pieces of identity that cannot be contradictory in order to form, this is basic logic.
Hmm.
So what we have is an absence, a suspicious absence of evidence. We've got planes that disappear from radar, so they basically went stealth. So we don't need to build stealth bombers. We can just turn off the transponder and make things disappear. So there's overlapping transponders going off over Stewart Air Force Base and then going back on. Now, how did the Arab hijackers, why did they do what's going on there? So there's all these contradictions that you have to resolve. So I cannot say without a shadow of a doubt that tail numbers cited as flight numbers had anything to do with those explosions, because I have never seen evidence. I know what people think they saw on TV,
yeah.
And I also know, as you know, being a cinematographer and an editor, that there's a lot of things that can be done to show people to cause them trauma through media, because I've had to study all the psychological warfare that I experienced in order to answer my own questions. And so, you know, there's plenty of contradictions in any of the footage that you look at. I recently watched the MSNBC replay on 9/11, and every few seconds there are serious contradictions in what they're showing you, and you should really look at the footage with a critical eye and start to, you know, observe and note these contradictions and try to answer them for yourself, because I think that's what we're all trying to do, is come to reasonable, objective answers that do explain the evidence without neglecting certain aspects of evidence in order to formulate what we think happened.
That's very well said. And this was a point I wanted to return to as well. As you sit in the car on, I forget the street now, sorry about that.
It's Vesey Street that goes between the World Trade Centers right there.
Yeah, and you see Tower 2 explode, and you've obviously looked at the footage and everything and tried to just pinpoint, okay, where am I at in correlation to where the plane should have been and everything else. But when you're sitting there, there's nothing that you hear or see that indicates that there was a plane anywhere there in the vicinity.
During my interactions that morning, at no time did I hear anything fly over. I was on West Side Highway, so if something flew over and hit World Trade Center 1 at 1,000 feet at 500 miles an hour when I had the top down, I should have heard it, but I didn't. So if it did, then, you know, that's just, you know, whatever it is. Tower 2, I heard nothing. Like, I had no notice of it until the building exploded. So I was on the north side of that building. If there was a plane, I wouldn't have seen it. But in examining the footage from Tower 2, there's a lot of contradictions. There's a lot of trajectory changes of whatever that object is approaching it from the different angles. And I have footage that you can find it on the internet. There's footage of World Trade Center 2 blowing up without anything flying into it. And then when you compare that to it's Luke Korchesny is the original photographer for that. He's a 3D animator and artist who has the capabilities to do exactly what you're looking at, to take a footage that doesn't have anything in it, to put something in it, and then to mass propagate that through the mass media networks and have everyone think whatever they're being shown. Because the problem is, you know, Ann Tatlock was the CEO of the fiduciary trust company that was in World Trade Center 2. That's the site of the second explosion. So Marsha McLennan's is the site of World Trade Center 1's explosion. Fiduciary Trust is World Trade Center 2's explosion.
Mm-hmm.
She was with Warren Buffett in Omaha at his last annual golf tournament that also happens to be right near the Air Force base where Bush went later that day. So the same town, the same place, you've got billionaires and CEOs of these companies being affected, and later that day the president comes out there to visit. So I'm not saying that's proof of anything. I'm just saying I'm not a believer in coincidence theory. All I study is forensic history and the fact of who benefits, who was, you know, participating. Warren Buffett's companies, Berkshire Hathaway and all these other insurance companies were involved in the properties there. They were part of the settlements. And, you know, people should look more closely at this, because we're not looking for an external enemy that lives in a cave that, you know, has some sort of terrorist force that trains on monkey bars. We're talking about people with three-piece suits that are looked up to as great investors in this country, and they're truly internationalists who want globalism to dissolve our borders and to, you know, create this organic unity of Darwinian social eugenics and propagate that into the future. And I just think that we can do a better job than what we're doing right now in communicating that.
Indeed. And it's amazing, too, when you think about it, how many people must have been there that day, witnessed this to a certain degree, but at the same time, in hindsight, they might have been, I don't know, because of what they've seen on the media, no longer trust their own senses and eyes and ears and everything else. And it's like they have to turn on the TV to get the story of what happened. And then they walk away as believers from whatever they're being fed on the TV. I don't know how many people have been spoken out and say, you know, I didn't see anything, or this was not what I seen. I think that there are people who have been talking about this. There were but they didn't see anything. But they saw the explosions, just as you describe. But still, it's amazing. It's got to be thousands of people that were there and witnessed it, yet so few are speaking out in that regard about this.
Well, and I think, you know, there's a lot to be learned there, because psychological warfare and the type of trauma that was handed out via the snuff film, which was shown at its multiple angles over and over again, but it's never showing you the critical parts. It's always just showing you the same standard replays. And it's in those other parts that they cut out of the live footage that the truth exists and is more blatantly obvious. And so it's more about learning how to observe and focus and be attentive and to notice these contradictions and how to raise the questions and how to find the substantial and relevant answers. That's the way we can all work through that trauma. Because, yes, there are plenty of people who were there that morning. And I'm not saying that there wasn't anything that flew into that building. I'm saying the questioning of the hijackers and the identities of the hijackers and the planes is highly erroneous. There's a lot of contradictions. And if the evidence was clear, cut, and dry, I would have no problem believing that story. It is because so many aspects of legitimate evidence are regularly dismissed or neglected purposely for obfuscation and censorship, or are hidden because the people talking haven't done enough questioning and research into the general information behind this. And it's not like there's not a 100-year history in America of globalism being carried out and eugenics and the use of covert intelligence agencies that are run by the banks and the people that control the government, our non-elected rulers. If all that history hadn't been there, if there hadn't been a big history involving September 11th, 1922, with the British mandate over Palestine to create a future Zionist state, or if there wasn't September 11th, 1973, where we flew a plane into Yende's palace and put in a military dictator. That was CIA. That was Kissinger. So if these other people and these other historical events had not happened preceding 9/11, I wouldn't necessarily have the feelings that I do about it. But being that there's all these contradictions in 9/11 and they tie into the very same people who have been doing these other activities, that is something we have to take notice of, because that is the reality. And I think it's tragic for large numbers of people. These are just, these are individuals trying to survive, and they think it's harder to think than it is to be traumatized and used basically as a servant or a slave through not thinking, because it's in the outsourcing of our thinking. It's in the reaction to stimulus without thinking in between. That's how they control all of us.
Yeah.
They get us to create habits that are in direct conflict with our needs of survival, and they get us to love our servitude, which was one of the things that Aldous Huxley pointed out in the Ultimate Revolution speech back at Berkeley. They wanted to get us to love our servitude. They've done a great job at that, but we don't have to remain in that unblissful ignorance, because ignorance is not bliss. It truly is not.
I agree. I agree. I think and what's interesting here as well is that this is a continuing story, as obviously you've clarified at this stage, not only the consequences and the effects, if you will, of what happened there has now played out on the geopolitical scale, but also in the destruction of evidence. Companies have been, as you said, nationalized and bailed out. They've been bought up and everything. So it's still continuing to this day. And I can't help to think that even the 2008 economic crash to a certain extent plays into all of this as well, Richard, that they've wanted to continue to kind of both muddy the waters, but also kind of continue to cover it up to a certain extent of having many of these companies suffer under the economic turmoil that we've been in and still are in, and hence they can continue to cover this up, and it becomes increasingly, the further removed we are, it becomes more and more difficult to follow all the threads, because only what you've laid out here now shows an incredible network of connections between different people, between different companies, between different groups, and a different probably agendas on their that level as well that we're talking about. But lots of highbrow people up there who are seems to have their finger in this to one extent or another, and it's pretty scary.
Well, and it's still ongoing, as you mentioned, in the 2008 and ongoing financial crisis. That also ties back into 9/11, because what you had the week before 9/11 was the crash of Enron, which was, you know, a pretty big deal, but they don't really talk about it too much. And actually, the Monday before, so it was September 10th. On September 10th, 2001, Donald Rumsfeld reported that the Pentagon had lost and could not account for $2.3 trillion. But and that was lost the next day with the news of 9/11, because the part of the Pentagon that blew up happened to have the accounting records. And that is that's coming from the Pittsburgh, I think it was the Post-Gazette, an article by Milan Samovich. So this is, you know, he says that, you know, this is where the accounting was. And this is, you know, he's a Pentagon reporter. And so when you put all these little disparate pieces together, what you're left with is there are non-elected rulers. There is a conspiracy to end nationalism and to end individual sovereignty and to basically communize, which means sacrifice of the individual to the state,
yep.
Meaning that you have no more rights. And an aspect of that is the financial crash. So you have Enron crashing. You have the Arthur Andersen scandal. You had Tyco, these sort of things. So this is in the year after 9/11. I go to work for a company called Legato, L-E-G-A-T-O, which was subsequently purchased by EMC Corporation, a multi-billion dollar funder of, you know, it's a corporation that helped to fund Bush and Cheney into office. So I went to work at this company, Legato, because they were selling a product that was mandated by Congress to help prevent fraudulent accounting. And something that I saw, that's a danger to national security, all this fraudulent accounting, because it's messing with everyone's lives through the economy. So I went there to sell this product that would help prevent these crimes from being, you know, taking place.
Hmm.
And one of my clients was Tyco International. So it was one of the first meetings that I had, one of the first higher-level meetings that I'd had while I was working at Legato. And I'm sitting with the chief general counsel of Tyco International, who's under SEC mandate and FBI investigation, and they can't delete data. And I'm telling them how they can use this software to do everything that they're mandated to do. And she says, I don't want to do anything like that. I want to know how to hide this information. I want to know how to delete it. I want to know how to cook the books. And I was kind of beside myself because I had not experienced that sort of direct corruption in a meeting before.
Right.
And there was someone else at the table on my side. It's like, oh, we can talk about that. We know how to do that. And so what I discovered was, and this was a subsequent meeting the next month at the National Association of Securities Dealers, the NASD, which is a watchdog for the stock market. And they're explaining to me across the table saying, hey, you know, you guys have a backdoor in this product where you can put information in a staging area, you can delete it, and then it acts like you never did, you know, never had it. So they're like, we're not going to buy this. And so I'm starting to add up all these contradictions, and I bring it to my boss's attention because I thought naively that these guys would want to know about it. Well, lo and behold, not only did they know about it, but that's why EMC had bought Legato, because they knew that there was this product that they could obscure all this financial fraud from investigators. Because the investigators looking at the software would say, oh, this company's clean. And so I blew the whistle. And so I naively, on my 30th birthday, called the SEC, and I said, I have this information. You guys are already investigating my company. And I called the lawyer at the SEC who was investigating Legato. And I said, I have this information, and it's even bigger than I thought. And, you know, I can provide this to you. And he said, you know, we can put you in prison for giving this information to us. And that's not what I expected from the, you know, an attorney at the SEC, for him to tell me basically to, you know, to take a walk. They don't want to know about it. And 6 months later, the SEC purchased and standardized on the software that we were selling at Legato for the Sarbanes-Oxley Compliance Act of 2002. So now I'm like, wow, the, you know, 9/11 has happened. There's all this crazy confusion, chaos with that. And in my professional life, trying to do the right thing, I had whistleblower protection. I had educated clients on the Sarbanes-Oxley Act and the whistleblower protection. And so certainly I thought when I blew the whistle, I would enjoy this regulatory protection, but it does not exist. It's a trap, as Admiral Akbar would say in Star Wars. It's a trap. And so you're basically, in blowing the whistle, you are providing the information to the top people running the scam so they can keep a lid on it.
All right.
So this blew my mind, and I said, I got to go to the media. So I had seen this movie, The Insider. It's got Russell Crowe and Al Pacino, and it's a fictional, or, you know, a stylized Hollywood depiction of a real life guy who was a whistleblower. And so the journalist that Al Pacino is playing was this guy named Lowell Bergman, who does PBS Frontline. So I was like, I'm gonna fax Lowell Bergman, and I'm gonna get a dialogue with him, and I did, and that part actually worked. And he had an investigative team of two editors working on the story, and a year later, they say, we can't do this story. And I'm like, why? And they're like, we were already told, like, one of them lost their job at the newspaper. They worked at two different newspapers, these editors. And the other one was told if he goes with this story, he'll lose his job. And so Bergman wastes my time for a year, and now I'm another year down the road thinking that something was going to be done, but it's not been done.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is reflected later in the interview I did, 2020 hindsight censorship on the front line. I explained the whole situation of the whistleblowing and the Sarbanes-Oxley content that's on tragedyandhope.com. You can watch it for free. So if you're interested in this sort of thing, because I was trying to prevent what I saw as a catastrophic financial collapse because of this huge loophole that's being left for people to commit fraud. And they're not just going to do it 8 hours a day. They're going to be committing fraud 24/7 as long as they can until they get caught. That's how they operate. And so as I worked through each layer of my naivete and things that I thought were impossible were not only possible, but that's how the world was working, I took it upon myself. I had a responsibility since I was getting in the middle of all this research to leave a trail of breadcrumbs. And so I had started producing I started with Project Constellation, but that was just a message that I was trying to get some facts in front of some people who had audiences so maybe that we could learn more. And I saw that wasn't very effective, so I started doing a podcast, 9/11 Synchronicity, and that was more like a stream of consciousness sharing what I was encountering as I was surveying this alternative media landscape that had been so well hidden from me all my life. And then we started making, some documentary films, and admittedly, I used my first films as an excuse just to put text on screen because I didn't know how to show anything in pictures yet, so there's a lot of text in my earlier films.
Mm-hmm.
But more and more, through the films, through creating our online community, now we've got 2,000 people around the world who are likewise looking into their own lives, asking these questions, searching for answers, and we just try to do a good job of providing this information out there so you don't have to recreate the wheel. If you have questions on eugenics or Agenda 21, you're not the first person to ask these questions. We can pretty easily answer the general questions, and then we can all explore this more critical, nuanced aspects of it, as we go, because that's what we're all trying to learn, these different angles, so we can protect ourselves. And then I launched the Peace Revolution podcast, which is an online curriculum so you can do self-study on your own time. But it's all the topics that we should be taught about as responsible adults so that we can be self-reliant. And these are the topics that are purposely left out of our public and private education systems. What I leave in the curriculum of Peace Revolution is really, here's the trail of what exists in a credible way with the references and primary sources, so that if you're interested in, understanding any given topic that we cover, you can get what I feel is a comprehensive perspective and an outline of where you can explore beyond that so you can avoid the pitfalls in life.
Very good. Thank you, Richard. I mean, and again, what I like about what you guys do is you go that extra mile to continue the search and continue to kind of also view the larger picture, the larger extent, which is, I think, potentially a very difficult thing to do when one has experienced the things that you have, and it might be very, very easy, shall we say, to maybe just focus on by no means low-level corruption, but the fact that it's like this tentacle and this beast that you've witnessed within the business world and all the connections it has to the companies that you work for and the software and everything else that you developed, and it can be easy to just kind of stare yourself blind almost, if you will, only on that aspect alone, because it's immensely important, and it's immensely important to give that out. But, you know, as I'm trying to say here, you go that extra mile of asking the bigger questions and put it into, I think, as well, a bigger, larger context, and also then consequently try to use this whole, you know, accident and horrible event as a kind of an educational experience, and actually using that as a hands-on tool as an example to kind of proceed and teach people how to, you know, as you said, to kind of avoid some of the pitfalls and the fact that basically using this as a perfect example of taking people out of that mindset of being basically naive and just believing whatever the media is saying, and again the fact that we haven't learned about how to break these things down for ourselves, education, and realizing that we can use certain measures to understand and see the fallacies in this, and we can see the contradictions, and therefore just beginning to ask the simple questions. What is going on? Something's wrong here, and why is it being covered up? So good job, Richard. Thank you for that.
I also had to ask the questions, you know, does me being naive, does that benefit me? Does that help me survive? And does, if I deny what exists, how does that help me? And so I had to come to terms with just basic questions as an individual, just like everyone else that finds themselves on this planet spinning at 1,000 miles an hour in this crazy situation that we thought, I mean, that public schooling's job is to make us think we know things without actually having done the work to ask the questions and find the answers ourselves. So it is very opposite of the process of learning. It is the denial of learning, but giving you the satisfaction that you think you've known something from that process, which you don't. And so we go through life as adults thinking we know things, and that prevents us from asking questions and actually getting to, you know, familiarize ourselves with reality. And that is very much what keeps us in a state of extended adolescence, because it's the pseudo-knowledge. It's these illusions that we take as knowledge that are really blocking our discovery. And that kills off our curiosity when you think you know everything already because
sure,
you've been through school.
Yeah.
And that is the simple control system that they have defined, and they just permeate it in a million different ways through our culture. But, you know, at any point, we can all choose to stop and just observe and to, you know, work our way out of it. I didn't start this research looking into 9/11. I started, you know, it was after 9/11. We've got the war on terror. There are these Muslim extremists trying to get us. And so I was trying to understand what is the nature of their religion and philosophy. And then I bumped into, you know, my own, you know, upbringing as a Protestant. I started looking at the various aspects of Christianity and the various sects of Christianity and how they evolved. And so really my research started as more of a world religious study, you know, to give myself a history that I didn't get in college. But then once I came across Wahhabi extremism and these sort of things, I thought I had solved the contradictions. I'm like, oh, this is who they're looking for. But then I started bumping into more and more information that led, you know, that the Wahhabis were being artificially funded through the Muslim Brotherhood, and that was funded through the intelligence agencies, and that was funded by the bankers. And so the more I looked into it, the further away from the official story I got. And what, you know, what you see is the biggest lies out there are the ones that the public believes. When they tell us that, you know, here's this cut and dry story of 9/11, and here's this 9/11 commission report that supposedly backs it up. But I think one of the things that Mark Gaffney didn't mention was the reason that things aren't in the 9/11 commission's findings is because each and every fact in that report had to be unanimously agreed on
to
get into that book.
Yeah.
So when you look at who was on the 9/11 commission and who, what do they do? You've got people that work for United Defense. You've got people, you know, like Zelikow, who has a highly suspect history. He wrote an article in Foreign Affairs in 1998 with John Deutsch, who's also involved in 9/11 and CIA and banking and all this stuff. They wrote an article together on catastrophic terrorism, talking about, they didn't use the word a new Pearl Harbor, but they used another phrase that was pointing toward a new Pearl Harbor. They used the phrase weapons of mass destruction. And in that same issue of Foreign Affairs, published by the Council on Foreign Relations in 1998, there is another article that talks about Osama bin Laden, you know, public enemy number one. And so they have these two ideas that are in 9/11 a couple years later, catastrophic terrorism, weapons of mass destruction, Osama bin Laden, and it's foreshadowed 3 years earlier in a Council on Foreign Relations publication. So when Bernard Lewis is describing in that publication Osama bin Laden and how he's this world terrorist, that's them communicating to their audience, here's our upcoming plan. So
yeah,
these people exist, they're organized, they have publications, they write memoirs. There's all sorts of information out there that's highly credible. That's the reality. That is what more and more of us need to familiarize ourselves with. We need to read Foreign Affairs so that we have an idea on their game plan and their thinking, because we cannot fight something effectively if we cannot understand it. Now, we're up against, you know, they're basically psychopaths. They're technically intraspecific kleptoparasites. Intraspecific meaning of the same species, and kleptoparasites meaning they act parasitically and they plunder from people who produce.
Yeah.
So once we can define what we're looking at, what we're experiencing, we can then start to formulate, you know, communication strategies and eventually do something effective about it.
Indeed, very good. We're going to take a break here in a little bit. We're going to carry on, of course. But again, I just want to reference people to the website tragedyandhope.com, and also, of course, click in there on the podcast and check out the 9/11 Synchronicity podcast that was going from 2006 to 2009, and you can subscribe right there as well. And then, of course, Project Constellation, connecting these dots, and a lot of this is a lot of interesting material here that you need to hear and dig deeper into as well. And yeah, it's really good stuff. Anything else, by the way, Richard, you want to give out here before we take a break here between the segments here?
Sure. The homepage for my podcast or the curriculum called Peace Revolution is at peacerevolution.org. You can listen from the first episode all the way up through if you want a step-by-step graduation of this information. Or you can just jump in the later episodes on Agenda 21, technocracy, cybernetics, all these different topics that we are in the midst of, but we don't necessarily, we're not aware of it. We might not understand it to the highest extent that we can. And so I like to put that out there. Also, the ultimatehistorylesson.com. It's a weekend with John Taylor Gatto. It's an essential 5-hour interview where he lays out how the non-elected rulers control human resources. It's available on ultimatehistorylesson.com. It's also on Amazon. And there's an IMDb page up, so if you have seen it already, I would appreciate a review, because we're trying to get it out to some film festivals and spread John's message. And last but not least, I believe there's a Facebook page for the Ultimate History Lesson, and there's a bunch of people who have seen it there, and you know, if you have questions, answers are provided.
Absolutely, and again, if you like what they do, subscribe, help the guys out here, and sign up for a subscription, and of course, get in and witness and take a look at all the other things that they have for you there as well.
Well, like your show at Red Ice Radio, we're commercial free, we're advertising free. Everything I do is in a sense, it's very much just like what you do, Henrik. It's what we would want for ourselves. We don't want to sit and listen to something and every couple minutes have to scrub through a commercial while we're doing something else. And it's more about how people consume the media. I make long productions to help extend people's focus and attention. And it provides a lot of people who are driving or running or doing any of these other activities to take in some healthy information while they're mowing the grass or doing anything else that they might see as mundane. And I get a lot of positive feedback because you can really dig in. You can listen to an hour a day of one of the episodes and cover it over a week. Or you can sit down on a Sunday and really dig in and get your notes going and learn something substantial that you're not going to get on corporate TV or radio.
That's right. True education and mind candy, as I like to call it sometimes. Good stuff that makes you, you know, give something. It's amazing when you think about it, too, in the way that people can do certain things on a monetary basis. And I'm not specifically, of course, talking to our audience here today, but I'm talking generally about people out there, about, you know, an issue of the New York Times. What was it? I was in a Starbucks when I was in the States the last time and looked at, what was that? It was a edition of the New York Times or something like that, and it was like $7, the Sunday edition or something like that. I was like, whoa, you know, you could get a...
You got to pay a lot for the propaganda.
Well, exactly.
And by the way, dude, next time you're here in the States, we got to hang out.
Definitely. We'll do that, Richard. And so absolutely. Help the guys out. Check out the website. We're going to have it linked up on redicecreations.com. We're going to carry on with more, of course, continue this story and dive deeper into it. So thank you for this first segment, Richard. Stay with us, and we'll be right back with more. We'll be right back. Stay with us in the second hour as we continue to have 9/11 in the background of our discussion while moving on to talk about enslavement through technology, psych warfare, voluntary servitude, and removal from the elite control system. Continue listening to this program and all our programs at redeyesmembers.com. Sign up for a membership and get instant access to all our archives on the new members' website. You can click around in the archives as a non-member as well to see what we have available for you. I'm sure you can find a lot of interesting topics that will interest you and that you want to learn more about. More Red Eyes Radio coming your way soon with guests Mike Cross, Seth Farber and Paul Levy, Kent Bain and Chris Milligan, Nick Begich, Dean Clifford, George Cavassalas, Troy McLaughlin, Randy Powell, David Icke, and many more. You can see a full list of upcoming guests in our radio archive. Thank you for listening. We'll be right back with Hour 2, together with Richard Grove.